Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Bob, the question stands in front of us. Are things returning to normal? It's going to be baby steps to get back to, let's say, life as it was in January or early February, but are we making progress?
Well, it seems like we're making progress. It seems like the psyche of people is such that they're ready for change. They're demanding change and yet remaining patient, right? That's kind of the sentiment you see out there. But when the government sends signals of staged reopening, things that are, generally well thought through, it all just makes you wonder, though, because you don't know what's next. You have no idea what's around the corner. It is all speculation at this point in time in terms of who does what, when's this going to end, et cetera. So normal is the question I'd posed for you. What the heck is normal, Eric?
No, I mean, that's going to be the thing here. We're going to change our definition. A lot of people are out here talking about the new normal, and, I think it just remains to be seen what exactly that will look like. But let's speculate on a slightly different topic. We talked last week about a lawsuit regarding a person who grew hemp. The hemp went hot. The plants were destroyed. And now they are seeking damages against the local law enforcement. Now we have another interesting related, not quite related, but a another lawsuit that has come to the forefront with a hemp company who bought seeds, and those seeds did not perform to what they were marketed as. This is this has been commonplace to some degree in the industry, and it probably will continue to be so here over the next couple of years until we really get standards in place. We, of course, have been talking about standards and standardization a lot today, but I'm interested in your thoughts on this. From a legal perspective, this company is seeking quite a lot of money in damages, but also, what is a court going to look at? What is it going to consider to make a determination on, how to proceed, how to rule on the court case?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certainly a dispute here, and I'm not familiar with all the facts. We're talking about a scenario where ultimately a gentleman who was attached to one of the largest decortication pieces of equipment in the country and his company were in a scenario to go out and cultivate industrial hemp either themselves through contract or otherwise. And ultimately a lot of seed needed to be purchased. Understanding the bare facts, it's hard to judge what occurred here. What's in the seed contract, et cetera. Did they know what they were buying? Did they get the right verification, certification, so forth and so on, that the genetics were appropriate? And, contracts in ag in particular, and these are ag contracts. Let's not mistake this anymore. This is not just the cannabis industry. These are ag contracts as these things unfold, as you need to supply material on a large scale for a decorticator, the size of which is located in North Carolina, that Hempig is attached to. So ultimately, you need good genetics. At the end of the day, if they didn't get what they acquired, then there's, certainly a viable claim there, but the contract's going to govern, so who knows?
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's there are great resources for how do you source your genetics. Talk to your State Department of Agriculture. If you're in a state that is kind of new to the game, talk to a State Department of Agriculture that's been handling this for a number of years. Colorado is a great example. Kentucky is another great example. They have comprehensive lists of varieties that have been planted and whether or not they are at risk of going hot or if they seem to be pretty stable.
That's the point. I mean, that's the lesson here, right? Regardless of the merits of the case, justice will run its course, so to speak. And ultimately, it teaches us as an industry, as operators within the industry, a couple of lessons. One I just mentioned, that we're not just talking about small-time cannabis deals anymore. We're talking about large-scale farming. And that doesn't mean that people are not qualified to participate in one or the other, but it's different and it requires some learning. And genetics is the first part of that entire process. And if you don't get what you need, then you're going to be out of luck. Your investors are going to be out of luck. Your business plan is going to be out of luck, out of gas. My point is that when you look at industrial hemp being embraced by a nation to help with increasing its agricultural productivity so it can participate and not suffer such an economic decline as COVID will certainly bring across the world. And you see that happening in other countries across Latin America in particular, Colombia, Mexico, Brazil, all looking at different opportunities, different ways to create or to facilitate a cannabis industry on a domestic and an export basis, and the fact that the European Union has dove in headlong on medical marijuana as a concept and as a policy. This is a plant that ultimately is here to stay, and if the government would put some focus and some emphasis on the fact that this should be planted far and wide in 2020 and beyond as a way for us to satisfy our food supply chain with protein, to utilize the fibers for particular purposes that were once used many, many years ago, as we described, on a global basis by our federal government, and the food and the cannabinoid content from the plant, not to mention the uses from the cellulose, the lignin, and the sugar. This is a plant that can bring us out of an economic decline if there's one to come.
You know, and it's interesting, and I'm, you know, kind of speculating here. This isn't exactly, you know, my area of expertise, but it does seem so important to have the government support in these Latin American countries. I mean, when you think about how hemp was legalized in the United States, you had Mitch McConnell and you had that strong support. And it's just, it's necessary in order to really mobilize and get seed, get the program in place, whether it's Costa Rica, whether it's Colombia. We've talked about the great, you know, story that you have coming from Yarumal. Switching gears a little bit, though, you mentioned the European Union. The European Industrial Hemp Association, longstanding trade organization out of Europe, they've taken kind of a strong stance on the novel foods legislation and rules that are kind of dictating how cannabinoids and cannabinoid extracts are being treated in the EU. They've come out recently, and they're trying to kind of counter what is in the novel foods language right now, basically saying that the rules are too restrictive, that it doesn't allow European countries to compete with the more progressive and aggressive policies coming out of, I don't know, Canada, the U.S., other countries who are kind of leading the industrial hemp charge. So, you know, interested in your thoughts on, you know, we've talked about novel foods a lot, but interested in your thoughts on, is novel foods too restrictive? I think we've talked about it being progressive to a certain extent, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. You can drill into the restrictions that it ultimately puts in place, or the regulation that it ultimately puts in place, which confines or at least limits the ability of the industry to operate, you know, in theory for the greater good, or for the public safety and the consistency of the industry. But at the end of the day, it's those standards that govern. And the fact that there is a straightforward pathway to bring a brand new ingredient to the marketplace, such as CBD. And again, is it brand new? It's certainly been a constituent part of hemp seed oil, hemp products that have been authorized by our FDA and international equivalents. But in these enriched or concentrated doses, I don't think our food supply chain, our supplement supply chain has seen that before. Let's be objective about this. And because of that, it could, I'm not saying it does, but it could, based on legal contest, which, you know, you're certain to see an administrative battle, at least with AHA and groups across the EU on this issue, it could go either way. But at the end of the day, it's much easier for an administrative body and an administrative adjudicator to say this is brand new because of its concentrated levels. And accordingly, you need to show that it's safe, and we need to create specific regulations for this product. And that process could take 2 years more. That is the threat of the industry. So it's a progressive policy, but it puts restrictions on the present day expansion of the industry and the players. And there has to be a balance that's stricken there. And I'm not so sure that we see one, because the one party, The EU Commission is taking this very, very seriously, and it has a standard path in terms of timing and how long these things take. And then you've got the industry that is operating and developing very, very quickly and moving things across the table. So they're almost at opposite ends of the spectrum. So something has to give, and maybe, just maybe, an AHA lawsuit is the catalyst for some sort of policy change, or at least a more deeper dive on a policy discussion.
Well, and in conversations that you and I have had, you know, we've never had any illusions about it. The U.S. more than likely does not really look to other countries to dictate the global standard. In fact, it's more than likely the other way around. And when the FDA comes out with those laws, those regulations, regulatory structure for cannabinoids, that will more than likely be the, you know, kind of what the rest of the world abides by. So, you know, well, much to be said and much to be thought of and much to be come later once we actually have a sense of what those regulations look like. But, you know, definitely good food for thought for right now.
Well, and think about this. To your point, the FDA, it's not perfect, right? By no means. There's many reasons to believe that, you know, it could be attached to large business and that influences policies and otherwise. But as an organization, it's highly structured and there's a process for nearly everything. And globally, it is the gold standard. Okay? The FDA is the gold standard. That's period. In fact, if you think about it right now, you know what the FDA's logo looks like because it is, in fact, the gold standard. You've seen it on a million commercials and products over the years. The point is the entity is what others will ultimately follow. We don't know the timing of those rules. We know they're working on them. We know what they're working on. We know what the timeline could be. But, you know, we've got a pandemic on our hands. So there's some things that there's some things that may not take precedence right now. But what ultimately comes out of it, does that happen before the novel foods issue is resolved, changed, lobbied, litigated? Who knows? I mean, that remains to be seen. And policies will ultimately align somehow, some way, even if it's 3, 5, 8, 10 years down the road, because they have to when you're dealing about a product, a plant that can create so many, service so many different verticals and industries on a global basis. It will require their attention and soon.
You know, we've been talking hemp. Let's look at the other side of the cannabis industry for a second, pull the focus over to marijuana. You know, we've talked a lot about this on the Hoban Minute, but California has had issues with their commercial market, let's say. And I want to talk specifically about licensing. They've limited the amount of licenses that they're issuing for cannabis businesses. And I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, what are the advantages to maybe not putting a cap on licenses or being a little bit more less restrictive than we're seeing with the cannabis regulatory bodies in California? There's a lot of issues there, but let's look at licensing and how that plays into some of those problems we're seeing.
Yeah, you make a good point about the number, a cap limitation on the number of businesses that can apply for a particular category of licensure. It tends to serve as a local government gateway in the U.S. Local governments can control the explosion, perhaps, or the threat of an explosion of an industry, you know, meaning that it would just proliferate and be everywhere. Marijuana Armageddon, if you will, which, by the way, some people thought here in Denver, South Broadway was Marijuana Armageddon. And these were, frankly, well-done stores over a very dense, packed area. But nonetheless, you know, certainly the impact was not terrible or adverse to society. And it all got cleaned up with regulation that ultimately did work together.
Just thinking about South Broadway, and for those folks who aren't familiar, I mean, you know, South Broadway, it fits into the culture.
The Green Mile, Eric.
The Green Mile.
That's right.
What else can you say? But, you know, here in Colorado, you know, I think we've seen a pretty successful rollout. We've had our challenges. We've you know, rose to the occasion and kind of identified what those were. We've had 6 years now or more to kind of work out the kinks, you know, and again, a theme that's common here on the Hoban Minute, the patterns that have emerged. really hoping that California just starts to kind of address this in a more, you know, proactive way.
Well, yeah, I mean, California is its own animal. We can't really analogize because it's a state that's effectively a country in terms of its economy and otherwise, 40 plus million people. I mean, it's larger than Canada. I believe, or at least within a couple million, 4 million of Canada's population. My point is, it's a juggernaut in and of itself. But to your point about the caps on licensure, we saw, take that policy for a second on a global scale. We see a country like Colombia. Colombia, anyone that could pay the fee to apply for a particular license and, of course, meet the criteria, check the boxes, could get a license. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of licenses and applications that more applications that went into an agency that was ill-equipped to handle something brand new that was probably slow-moving government agency anyway. So at that point in time, you would have looked at it and said, well, a Colombian license isn't particularly valuable because anyone can get one. There's no barriers to entry. So that's one of the things we've talked about with different governments that we've worked with or different pieces that we've crafted for different governmental bodies or on behalf of our clients, and that is to look at other ways to create barriers to entry. Having financial capabilities is a way to create barriers to entry, to limit the number of licenses without creating an artificial cap. And you can counterbalance that with some of the social justice, the social equity components that we see in other states. So it's not all bad if you create this component where there are barriers to entry, meaning let's not waste the government's time unless they're qualified individuals. And then you create a policy counterbalance that allows, you know, that social justice to be performed in the context of an equity program or, you know, country by country, social equity is going to mean very, very different things. If you do it that way, then you create a barrier to entry, but you leave it open to people that are organized and can put the right team together and the right experience, and you then create a product that the government can evaluate, put out into the marketplace, and policymakers, parents, you know, business owners can be proud that this industry exists next to their other, you know, counterparts up and down any street that has, you know, local business.
That was a home run response right there, Bob. Ending on a real positive note here, the Global Cannabis Stock Index. This is, you know, kind of tracks the cannabis stocks at a high level. It, you know, it, there was 2019 was a rough year. Cannabis stocks really, really were hit, especially in the third and fourth quarter. However, in this COVID world that we're living in, the month of April saw an 8.6% increase. Very positive. It does seem as though cannabis is a, you know, just at least, you know, is it really recession-proof, depression-proof? We've talked about that. But at the very least right now, they are performing well, and there does seem to be a strong pulse to this industry and an indication that, you know, the coronavirus and that this pandemic, you know, there will be a hit. There will certainly be an impact. But this is an industry that is strong. There's a bunch of really, really bright and successful and motivated people in this industry. They're going to get through this and come out very high on the other side.
I believe so. Like we talked about, economic opportunity, you know, people, particularly people in this industry. And let's not forget this, by the way. This industry was created, and the commercial element of the industry was created, and it grew enormously during a recession. And frankly, it grew because of the recession. All right? So follow me on this. You had a situation where you had developers and you had landscapers and you had so many small, medium business owners, self-employed people or self-made people, not talking about corporate America necessarily, although it impacted that as well. But these entrepreneurs, these business owners were all of a sudden affected by this economic slowdown, the recession. And that recession caused people to go out and look for other opportunities. And what do entrepreneurs do? They sit back and they look around. Now, some people are drawn to the industry because of the plant. And frankly, if you're drawn to the industry for reasons other than the plant, you do get attached to the plant. It's just, you know, it's an absolute fact. But folks came to different places. It was the Green Rush. Colorado was a recipient of the benefits of the Green Rush, where I can count on everyone's hands in this room that we We helped people that came out of those different industries that had some money to spend and a desire to take on a new challenge and a risk. And those are the folks that advanced this industry at that point in time. So I don't see this opportunity, this impact, as anything different than that. I really don't. Again, you hate to talk about the upside and everything when people are suffering and people are sick and people are losing their jobs. So not to be not mindful of that or disrespectful of that. I mean, that's something we think about every single day. But, you know, you have to think about how this affects everything and what direction it goes. And I do see that this is going to be a tremendous positive impact for the industrial hemp industry in particular, but the cannabis industry overall, as we see folks come in seeing essential marijuana businesses, as, again, essential, quote unquote. That's a major milestone. That's a major acknowledgement and recognition in the face of federal illegality. Why not participate in an essential business if things like this could become more common? And that certainly was something that a lot of people are thinking about.
A lot to be grateful for, a lot to be mindful of that's out there. But Bob, thank you for providing all your perspective, your insight on these issues, and another great go-around on the Hoban Minute with you, my friend.
Much appreciated. Thank you, sir. Have a good evening.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to Hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@Hoban.law. And stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.